Now, in just a few minutes, we will be joined by Marianne Faithfull. And I thought, since we started off the show by playing a whole bunch of summer's ending, summer's almost gone kind of songs, that we could play a real old, real early Marianne Faithfull song to usher her into the studio. She'll probably despise me for playing this. But it's called Summer Nights. No, that wasn't it. Oh, boy. I almost blew something really important there. Oh, well. Here it is. Now it's called Summer Nights. Nope, still not. What's with this machine today? I hate when this happens. I hate when this machine, the CD machine, just has a mind of its own and it cues up whatever song it wants to play. Someday I should just let it do that. I should just let it take over and see. Maybe it'll do a much better show than I'm capable of doing. That's a short song. Yeah. Marianne, that's a short.
They were always short.
There you go. We're just saying hello here. And the record ran out. So do you hate me for playing that? Is that this?
No.
Ancient.
I just haven't heard it for a long time. But
Summer Nights. Yeah. What, 1965 or something like that, right? 64, yeah, 65, yeah. No, 66, something like that.
65.
Yeah.
I think it was almost my last single from that period.
Was it really? Yeah. It is my pleasure to welcome to Idiot's Delight tonight a woman who has been both denounced as a witch by the Vatican and labeled a professor of poetry in the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poets by Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, yes.
And anybody who can do both is, you know, just like a winner in my book, certainly.
Well, thank you.
Marianne Faithfull is here. How nice to meet you after all these years. I feel like I've grown up with you. Well, you and I are pretty much the same age, and I was one of those, you know, boys who at age 18 or 19, when you were making your first records, had a serious crush on Marianne Faithfull, because you had that incredible look, you know. But that look was sort of what made you a pop star. It wasn't so much a desire on your part, as I read in your autobiography that has just been published called Faithfull. That look was what made somebody sort of point to you at a party somewhere and say,
Andrew, yes.
Her. Yes.
Andrew Oldham.
Can you move the microphone a little bit closer to Marianne?
I do.
There you go. That's good.
That.
Terrific.
No, I can't see you. Oh, right. Yes.
There you go.
Now, I've always heard, in the book it's a slightly different story. I think David got that story out of Andrew, but what Andrew told me...
David Dalton being the guy who wrote the book,
yes.
With you. Okay.
But Andrew told me that he just saw that I had a commercial face, which I always liked that one.
Now, Andrew Oldham was the Rolling Stones manager,
yes,
at the time.
Yes.
And he just looked at you and just felt that the look was...
Yes, it was. I mean, I suppose. It was that time. Jane Asher really was the sort of ultimate one, and there was Julie Christie.
Right. So it was long blonde hair, bangs.
Jane had red hair.
Okay,
but it was
right.
The same,
yeah,
look.
Right.
And I must have fitted into that. I didn't know, but I didn't care either, but I did.
So would you think of him then as being a kind of a Svengali figure?
Yes,
yeah, you
definitely.
Like
him. Without Andrew Oldham, I would not be sitting here today talking to you, you know? it's all Andrew's fault. Yeah.
And is it true that he then turned to Mick and Keith and the Rolling Stones and said, write a song for her?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, that's the fact, not then and there. But, I mean, I personally think, although it's obviously nice to that's the story, but
uh-huh.
Personally I think they had the song knocking around anyway. But Andrew realized that it wasn't really a song for the Rolling Stones, and it wasn't. It was As Tears Go By, and it was obviously a song for me.
That was not the original title, right? Wasn't the original title As Time Goes By?
Yes.
And somebody somewhere along the line said, oh, wait a minute.
Andrew changed it.
Yeah, he said, hold it, there is a very famous, successful song with that title. Maybe we should change it.
Yeah.
So Andrew Oldham changed it to As Tears Go By.
Well, apparently, yes. I hate saying everything I say is gospel, but I believe he did, yes.
Yeah. Now, did your version of it come out before the Stones?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yours was, and it was your song.
Yes, yes. And to all, I mean, sort of everybody believes it was written for me, and I must admit, even I believe it now.
Well,
I just don't know. I'm not quite sure. You know, my basic rule with David Dalton, and it worked very well, was if I wasn't there, we can't really write about it.
Uh-huh.
So I try to stick, or make David stick, to the things that I was there.
What?
So I wasn't obviously there when they wrote His Tears Go By, so I don't really know how it happened, but I like that story, that he locked them in the kitchen and said, write me a song with, I can't remember it, brick walls. And
oh, yeah, yeah, right. There's a whole quote in the book about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, what the heck? Those stories are probably
they're
great stories. You might as well go with them. It's so long now since all that stuff happened anyhow, you know.
Yeah. At the time, it irritated me because what came out, I think, was that somehow, because I was a pretty girl, I suppose, was that I must have been having an affair with one of the Rolling Stones for them to write that song for me, which, of course, wasn't true, because I was 17, and I didn't run away with Mick Jagger for another 2 years.
Right, all right.
So when you're young, you mind these things, so I did mind. But, of course, it doesn't really matter now.
So you just, in the spirit of the 60s, in the spirit of that time, you just went along with it. You just said, well, okay, I'll make a record. I'll be a pop star.
Well, I didn't know what that meant, honestly. I mean, I really didn't. I did it because I am, of course, game for things like that. You know, like I'm very interested in all these sort of things. And I had a lovely voice. And in my heart of hearts, I must have believed it somewhere, what Andrew said to me. I'm going to make you a star, baby. I mean, there was another part of me that was very, very sort of ambivalent about it. But that's how I am. I've always been ambivalent.
Well, you had a sort of an interesting upbringing. Your family on both your mother's and your father's side were kind of interesting.
Very,
and on the
very
mother's side, your mother was a
my
baroness.
My mother was a dancer, too, you see. So she
Sort of a free spirit?
I guess she was, yes, in Berlin in the 30s before the war.
Pronounce the name of the family.
Sacher Masoch.
Sacher
Masoch.
Masoch, which the Masoch part gave the world masochism. And he was he's like your great-great-uncle.
Mm.
He wrote a book
called Venus in Furs.
Venus
in Pelts.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Which the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed and Velvet Underground, turned into a song.
Yeah.
And that's the book from which the phrase
masochism
comes
it's kind
from.
Of amazing being related to Leopold Sacher Masoch. Of course, I just take it for granted.
But there certainly is an element of a masochistic tendency in Marianne Faithfull's story.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. Not literally. Mm-hmm. You know, I think.
You don't think that you courted all sorts of pain at times?
Well, it just certainly looks like that doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does.
But I didn't think of, no. I certainly didn't do that. No, I didn't. I wasn't. I really was a little girl looking for excitement, romance, and all those wonderful things, not for pain at all. Every woman has a certain bit of masochism. All women have a slight touch of masochism in them. But mine was never sort of a medical condition.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. You were a little Catholic girl, too, which I think is perhaps important. Spent time in convent schools and
well,
that
I
whole
thing. Yeah, well,
I
was brought up in a convent. Yeah. I didn't become a Catholic till I was 8. So, in a way, if what the Jesuits say is true, give me a child until they're 6 and it will be mine forever. My Catholicism was obviously grafted on.
Uh-huh.
It didn't go that deep.
Right.
But still, it took me nearly a lifetime to deprogram myself. So mine must have gone quite deep.
As it does for many of us,
yes,
to
indeed.
Deprogram ourselves from that. But wasn't part of what you got involved in that period, 1965-66, of rebellion against that,
sure,
that
I'm
upbringing?
Sure it was, yes. Mm. I was just dying to get out of Reading, you know. That's where I grew up.
Right? What was Reading like?
Reading is just like, I don't know what the equivalent would be.
Is it industrial or suburban?
No, it's it's quite near London. It's just the sort of, it's not exactly suburban.
Yeah.
It's just I think they call them dormitory towns.
Oh, yeah, like bedroom communities,
yeah.
Right. You know, like some of the towns up in Connecticut and over in Jersey, people commute.
It's really dull,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I found it really dull anyway. And I was dying to get out of Reading and get out of school and get out of all of it. And Andrew Oldham, by asking me to record as Tisgab, I kind of did that for me, you know.
Mm.
He sprung me.
Now, you were at a party, right?
Yes. Now, it wasn't just any old party. It was quite a fancy party. And it was 1964. And I was with my first boyfriend, who I was going to marry later, and have my son with, mm-hmm. John Dunbar. And John was a great friend of Peter Asher, from Peter and Gordon.
Peter and Gordon, yeah.
And Paul McCartney was going out with Jane Asher, who was Peter Asher's sister. This was very complicated. And I went to this party with John, my John. And, of course, everybody was there. Everybody who was anybody at that moment was at this party. It was a launch party of a new girl singer called Adrian Poster. And, of course, John Lennon was there and Paul McCartney and all the Beatles, George Harrison, and Mick and Keith and Brian and Andrew.
Mm. And this is like right in the height of that swinging mod London,
it
right?
Definitely, I mean, it's that bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's all those great black and white movies from that period that captured it.
What
you know, blow up
called?
And all
I
those kind
that
of things.
One. No, Blur wasn't black and white.
Was it? Was it?
No, Blur
that
was
in color.
Color?
Was
but there
color?
Was one. There was a wonderful one by Dick. It was a Dick Lester movie. Oh God, with Rita Tushingham in it.
The Taste of
Not Taste, that
no?
one. No. It was the one about where all the girls are lining up.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Terrence Stamp was
yes. I can't. I can't remember either.
I can't.
You know who just died this week? Lindsay Anderson, the filmmaker.
Did he?
Yeah. There was an obit in the Times the other day.
Ooh.
Who made a couple of classic,
If
one of the great movies about the revolution and the ruling class.
Yeah.
An absolutely hysterical movie with Peter O'Toole as a sort of Christ-like figure, an aristocrat who thought he was Jesus. And eventually wound up
a common delusion among the aristocratic classes. Yeah.
So, I mean, to consider that this period that you're talking about and these people and the relationships that eventually you got involved in have become a part of pop mythology.
Yeah.
You know, that it's almost as if we're talking about the gods on Olympus, you know, and Peter Asher was there, and Mick Jagger, and Marianne Faithfull was the young virgin being sacrificed on the altar of whatever, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, and it's not, it's you, it's you're a real person,
well,
whose
yes.
name is really Marianne Faithfull,
yes,
you know,
really,
your father's name was Faithfull.
My father is Glyn Faithfull.
Yeah. See,
my grandfather was Theodore Faithfull, mm-hmm. and on. But, I have to sort of remember that to young people now, to young people today, this is like the 18th century or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for you, it's your life, and it's your past. And
I'm delighted if it turns people on.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's all right. I guess I mustn't take it too much for granted. You see, I don't know anything else. So to me, it was just that's how it was. I went to that party. John and I went, really not because of all these wonderful people. I remember quite clearly going, we were very poor. John was a student at Cambridge. I never used to get enough to eat when I came up to London. And I knew that at these parties you would have this fabulous feast laid out, and indeed there was. And all this thing, when this was all going on with Andrew Oldham and whatever they saw, I was actually focusing on getting myself fed.
Oh, that's
as
great.
As it was going on.
Right.
So obviously that know, nothing really changes. This is always my main sort of interest.
Food.
Food, sleep, you know.
Survival.
Those kind of things, yes. But I guess I must have wanted it. I must have wanted something like, I don't really remember Andrew ever saying, I'll make you a star, but I'm sure he did.
Mm.
And something about that must have made my heart beat faster in some way.
And it turned into this. Recording that was released in 1965 and became a huge international hit. The first recording from Marianne Faithfull. And then the Stones eventually did record it, I believe, on... Was it Between the Buttons that they finally did it on?
Or? On very obscure forms. The first time I heard a recording of the Rolling Stones doing this Tis Goodbye was in Italian.
Really?
Yeah. It never really came out on... I don't think it's on Between the Buttons.
Oh, you know what? I'm confusing it with Ruby Tuesday.
Yeah,
Ruby Tuesday.
That's another
one. There's an interesting thing in your book about Ruby Tuesday where you talk about Brian Jones being enamored of two entirely different kinds of music and trying to unite them on that. The old blues of
and
Robert
the
Johnson.
Elizabethan air.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And when you stop and think about
Skip James and mm-hmm. Lord Essex or something. Yes, I like that.
And he was like in the studio with the flute or the whistle or something like that, playing that thing.
It really is.
Marianne Faithfull has a book that has just come out that I have spent the last two nights. I've spent the last two nights with you, Marianne.
Oh, darling.
It's been quite an experience, cool. I'll tell you. About halfway through this book, Faithfull, I lost all of my sort of cynical disbelief, you know, that goes along with rock biographies written with people, you know.
A bit of cynicism is a good thing.
Yeah, you know, because most of these books tend to be sort of self-glorifying, self-serving kinds of things.
Yeah,
but about halfway through this book, as you are becoming just as hard on yourself as you are on anybody else. You don't pull any punches, really, in this book.
Mm.
There's a moment, I don't know when it was for me, where you just became extremely real.
Mm,
the voice in the book is certainly a vivid one. It's certainly not David Dalton's voice.
Oh, no,
you know,
no,
it's
no.
Your
it's
voice.
Very much like how I really am.
Did you tape record stuff with him? Did you? You didn't actually sit down and write any of this, did you?
I can write songs, but I mean, I'm not up for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd left it to me, it would never have got done. No, we did absolutely millions of tapes, hours and hours. He came to Ireland, he came to London, but really the main work of this book and the way he must have got the voice, which even now I'm surprised at how much it gets my turn of phrase and how I think. We came on tape on down the phone. We did a lot of that.
So do you know what I'm saying though about there's a point at which as a reader you just sort of go, oh my God, and you just kind of fall in love with this woman.
Well, you certainly believe.
Yeah,
I know that. I knew, and it was essential that, I mean, that was why it took so long, the book. And why it was so hard, because it had to be at least my version of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did it have to be the truth, but you, the reader, had to feel that, you see.
Mm.
There has to be a moment where the reader thinks, and you can always tell. You know, there's something, what do they call it, authenticity. You can just tell. If somebody's really lying, you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, you can also tell. And so obviously, somewhere in there, there is this moment where you feel it's real. Where, and truth, obviously, I hate to get all like this, but it's quite fun. Truth is relative, as we know. So my truth wouldn't necessarily be yours or wouldn't necessarily be someone else's.
Mm-hmm.
But once I had made up my mind to really work towards finding what my truth was, I stopped worrying about it, you know? And I think that worked.
Did you have to go through a period, and there's been a lot of publicity about the book, about some of the You know, the relationship with Jagger and the whole thing about you and Mick in bed one day and Keith is in the next room and Mick says, you know, what I really want is, I mean, like everybody, all the gossip columnists jumped on that.
Oh,
like,
I didn't understand it, man. I mean, it's an interesting story.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, everybody sort of knows that Mick and Keith have been skirting around each other for years.
Well,
you know.
Obviously it's never acted on, this stuff, and I never say it is.
Yeah.
But I know, as well as everyone else knows, underneath every work of great art, there's always it's obvious that the way you do these things is you use your sexual energy. It's nothing has to be done, nothing has to be acted on.
Mm.
It's an interesting story. And I've never thought of it as being that dreadful at all. To me, it's what all artists, especially in our highly ambiguous field of sort of, what is rock and roll? It's basically sex and seduction, isn't it?
Sex and seduction and,
well, it's got
and some
seduction.
Sort of anarchy in there as well, you know. And
defiance,
right.
Throw a bit of that in, and a good dash of cynicism, and you've got a cocktail.
Right. And certainly that period was such a, there was such an androgynous thing happening, especially in England at the time.
I mean,
especially in England at the time.
Not, of course, here in the United States, where we're all so healthy.
Right. But
you definitely English.
Thank you very much.
Very androgynous.
Thank you, Marianne.
Bullshit. You were just as androgynous in New York City as we were in London, and I'm sure of that.
Okay. Now, you were present at, I was always curious about this, your relationship with Allen Ginsberg. I was recently in Boulder, as a matter of fact, last weekend.
There?
I was out in Boulder.
Homage to Allen Ginsberg.
I was not at the Allen Ginsberg thing, but there were still posters up, and there were still newspapers.
The place was still reverberating with it.
Now that's the home of the Jack Kerouac School for Disembodied Poets at the Naropa Institute.
It's great fun. Everybody should always go to Naropa once in their life.
It's a very magical, mystical place out there in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains.
Isn't it
beautiful? It's a cool place.
It's a lovely little place.
And there's your picture and your name listed with all of these musicians and poets. And I'm going, well, Marianne Faithfull and
Anne. It was a no-show.
You didn't show?
I didn't show.
Oh, no.
I got the horrors, actually. It's the only, I love Alan so much. And I did, I'm afraid we did tease Alan a little bit in my book. There is a definite air of teasing.
Tell the story about how you came to meet Allen Ginsberg. In 1965.
No, it was 64.
Was it?
Really? Well, whenever the Dylan
tour. Yeah, it was a very famous.
It's all nailed on those things that I always forget. It was on a, I met him in the Savoy Hotel, where I had gone to meet Bob Dylan. And Alan, I mean, we became friends from that moment. And the famous story Alan always tells is that I was his date when we went to the Albert Hall. I was actually at a friend's house, at Hal Wilner's house, I don't know if you know him.
Sure, the producer.
On Friday night, I went over there to see them, Hal and Vicky. I hadn't seen them for a long time, and there was my manuscript. I'd given Hal a copy of Faithfull to read, and when it was still in manuscript, it's the most fantastic thing. There's my manuscript with notes in the margin by Allen Ginsberg, sort of annotated, like, just amazing.
Wow.
It's like the most priceless thing for me.
You mean Ginsberg got a hold of Hal's copy?
Yeah, Hal wouldn't let him take it out of the apartment.
Uh-huh.
It's safe here on Avenue B. But anyway, Alan got so into it that he would come round, because of course he's in it, so naturally he was interested. So he came round and would read it. Hal and Alan just finished a big, big poetry project of the complete works of Allen Ginsberg on disc.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were working together anyway, so I guess Alan was around a lot. And while he was there, in his sort of off moments, he would, And maybe that's it.
Well, this is it. And
that's the compilation.
This is it. It's a four CD set.
Oh.
And that is now Marianne Faithfull's copy of it.
Oh.
That's my gift.
No, Hal didn't give me a copy.
That's my gift to you.
Hal hasn't given me a copy yet.
It's not out yet, actually. It doesn't come out until this week, as a matter of fact. Tuesday's the official release date.
Well, my manuscript, I meant to take it home with me. I'm going to get it.
Yeah, you should.
Because it's the most incredible treasure. Now has, just like he is, of course, like a professor. So, so this isn't completely accurate. And all sorts of little notes.
That cranky old crotchety Allen Ginsberg thing.
Well, yeah.
Now, see, all right, now this party, though, or this, it was like a...
It wasn't a party. But it was just an audience.
It was a floating thing that was happening, though, in that hotel room.
Oh,
that much of which is captured in Penny Baker's film, Don't Look Back.
Indeed.
And I mean, that's the hotel room that we're talking about.
Yes.
Now, your particular scene or whatever is not captured on film, but...
Well, I'm
you
in
just,
that film, you know.
Yeah, you're in it.
I'm the beautiful blonde girl with my hair all over my face.
Right.
I hate it being filmed. I still do.
Sort of always in the corner
never
somewhere.
Never saying anything, never doing anything.
Well, the women were not allowed to say much or do much,
well,
right? Isn't that the case?
Yeah. I really didn't. I was very happy to do that.
But you describe Ginsberg as being the most, quote, normal person in the room.
Yes.
Which is... is a laugh to think of, but you're walking into a room with Dylan and Bobby Newworth and guys from the Animals were hanging
everything,
out, and Alan Price and all those people.
Yeah.
And
but you know, it's not surprising really, because my father was a university lecturer, and my father's a professor of Italian and Renaissance studies, so I would be able to relate to Alan because he is very, in whatever anybody, I don't know how. I think of Alan as incredibly sane myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Naropa at Alan's invitation, and while I was there, I mean, it's all been so wonderful, my whole friendship with Alan. Philip Whalen taught me to meditate when I was at my first visit to Naropa. And I've been back lots of times since.
Mm-hmm.
Alan is always there, you know, where it's happening at the time. That's how he is.
Well, now, the interesting thing, and I love the way this all kind of ties together, you met him in this hotel room, and it was 1965.
It was
1965.
I'd seen him before in Paris.
Okay.
No, of course I hadn't. I wasn't even married yet. That was on my own. Mm. See, it's no good asking me these questions. Yes,
right.
You're right. I'm sorry. It was the first time I met Alan.
He had just come back from Prague,
yes,
where he had been crowned.
Well, actually, he was crowned Queen of the May.
Queen of the May. But
I don't know why we didn't say that in the book.
It became King of the May in the poem. And I thought, if you don't mind, we could play Ginsberg reading that poem, because this is the exact, and this is a recording that was made in London at a bookstore, probably right around the time that you met him.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Miles is, I would have met Alan one way or another, even if I hadn't gone around to the bookstore.
Alan Ginsberg.
Carl Mayallet.
Alan Ginsberg, recorded in 1965, right around the time he met my guest tonight, Marianne Faithfull. How amazed and shocked we all were when we heard Broken English, because we remembered...
Very natural change. Mate.
That's a lot of cigarettes, Marianne.
I don't... Well, maybe. I mean, I can't say it's not. Of course, it must be connected to whiskey and cigarettes and all the other stuff. But I still really do think that my voice was always going to become like that. I was, even when I was very young, when I was studying classical music and had a beautiful soprano voice, and they knew even then that my voice would become mezzo.
Really, that it would change, huh? Was that, is your mother's voice a deeper, huskier voice?
Yes, my mother's voice was very low, but she couldn't sing at all. She was a dancer.
Marianne Faithfull is my guest here on Idiot's Delight. We have to pause here for some commercial messages. This is WXRK New York. It's 92.3 K-Rock. I'm Vince Gelsa, and I am tickled and delighted to have Marianne Faithfull as my guest this evening. She has a book, an autobiography, which has just come out. It is entitled Faithfull. And there's also, in conjunction with the release of the autobiography, a release called Faithfull, a CD release, which has... Somehow I can't call this a greatest hits. I mean, it's just, it's a nice retrospective of the latter part of your career, not the 60s stuff for the most part, but starting with Broken English. And it's got your incredible version of John Lennon's Working Class Hero and the Ballad of Lucy Jordan. And a couple of things that have not been released up until now, which I want to get to one of those in just a minute. So this is out as well, and the title of both of these, the book and the CD, are, the title is Faithful. Okay. Now, do you know about Dial-A-Mattress, Marianne Faithful? Now, you live in, where do you live in Ireland now?
Well, I live half in Ireland and half in New York.
Okay. Well, see, now, if you live half in New York, you should know about Dial-A-Mattress, because Dial-A-Mattress, it's an institution in New York.
Really?
Yes. This is a commercial now that we're doing. Dial-A-Mattress is a service that you can reach by calling an 800 number, right? And you can buy beds from them.
Over the phone?
Over the phone. Mattresses, futons, all sorts of sleeping things. And you get these beds and mattresses at real reasonable prices, because they don't have showrooms, so they don't have all this overhead and stuff.
But how do you know that you're getting a decent mattress?
Because everybody knows.
What would happen?
That it's Dial-A-Mattress. No, it's Sealy. It's Sealy
Posturepedic. They've got a good name.
Oh, yes. They've got an incredible reputation. And as a matter of fact, Commissioner Mark Green's Consumer Alert gives them a very high rating.
That's how you check. You have to.
I have the bed that I sleep on, that my wife and I sleep on, we purchased through Dial-A-Mattress.
And it's good, isn't
it? It's wonderful, nice, firm. It's not a king size, it's a queen size. Mm-hmm. One of these days I'm going to get a king size. You know what they have now? They actually have, Marianne Faithful, they have what are called folding kings now.
What's that?
Folding kings and collapsible queens or something. I don't know. It's weird. And you being an English woman, you would appreciate this, I think, folding kings and collapsible queens.
Sounds like a wonderful chess game.
Yeah, you know. Well, see, it's hard, for some people, it's hard to get a king size mattress into their apartment or their room, because they're so big, right?
Yes.
So they've actually invented now something that folds both the box spring and the mattress, so they get. And Dial-A-Mattress is the place to go for folding kings and queens.
If
ever you need a mattress,
I'll do that.
No matter where you are in America, because they deliver anywhere.
Yes.
And they deliver 24 hours a day. So you being, I would think, now since the Vatican actually labeled you a witch, I would imagine you're up late at night. You're a late night kind of person.
Yes.
Right? So if you wanted your mattress delivered to you at 2 o'clock in the morning.
They could do that.
They could do that. They would deliver to you at 2 o'clock in the morning. Wherever you are, anywhere in America. New York, Chicago, Boston, L.A., Florida, Baltimore. It's cool. What's your favorite place in America?
Well, New York, of course.
Yeah.
And then I'm very partial to San Francisco.
They would deliver it to San Francisco.
I like Texas, too.
Texas is nice.
Yes.
How about New Orleans?
I like New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans is cool.
Very much.
Okay.
I played there.
1-800. Where did you play?
Tips.
Oh, cool. Did you bow to the Professor Longhair bust at the... Oh, you guys... See, performers don't see the bust. Because performers don't come through the front door of Tipitina's. Performers go through the back door or the stage door. There is an incredible bust of Professor Longhair right at the front door, right as you go in, right by the front bar. And people literally bow to it and put drinks on the pedestal that the bust is on, and they give him cigarettes and stuff. You know,
I know about Professor Longhair, but no.
When did you play Tips? At what point?
Several times.
Yeah?
I played the... On my last tour in 1990.
Okay.
And I played there the first time in the 80s, early 80s. I can't remember when.
The Broken English period, maybe, then, huh?
It was after that.
Okay.
It was just after
that. Let me finish this commercial by saying you can reach Dial-A-Mattress at 1-800-MATTRES, which almost spells mattress. You leave off the last S because that's the S for savings, you see? Yeah. So you don't even have to remember a number. You just call 1-800-MATTRESS.
That is so cool.
And you leave off the last S for savings. Now... And I know Marianne Faithful will appreciate this. If you call an order between the hours of 10 p.m. and midnight, if you call and actually place an order with Dial-A-Mattress, they will give you a gift, a beautiful set. It says here, freshwater pearls, including a necklace, a bracelet, and earrings with a retail value of $50. So there you go. You get a bed and you get the pearls. It's like...
Yes, pearls are great, aren't they?
Like baubles, bangles, and beads.
And everything else that goes with it.
Now, Marianne Faithful... How many times a day do you stop and like pinch yourself and go, man,
It's amazing that I'm alive. Yeah.
all the time, I think. I don't think about it all the time, but it does heighten my awareness of the wonder and beauty of life, mm-hmm. I must say.
Because your story is just full of all kinds of scary stuff. I mean, you were a stoned out street junkie for many years. I mean, you talk in the book about reading William Burroughs for the first time and deciding that's at some point in your life you wanted to be that. And you didn't want to be, like, when we think of rock and roll junkies, when we think of Keith and Keith's battle with heroin addiction over the years, we think of a very sort of aristocratic,
it's very deluxe,
removed from the common ordinary street scene, you know. But you were a street scene junkie. You lived on a wall for a while.
Yes, I don't know why. I obviously wanted something that, and it was more than drugs. It was I wanted some sort of experience that tallied with my reading of The Naked Lunch. It's such an amazing thing to admit, really, that now, that you would go out and do that because you read a book.
Mm.
But, and there must have been other things involved, I'm sure. You know, I must be an addictive personality and all that stuff. But what I got in that 2 years when I lived on my wall was something I hadn't had really before, which was complete anonymity and complete acceptance for who I was at that moment with no strings. You know, those people were very good to me. They were very kind to me and they looked after me, and I wasn't able to look after myself for that.
When you say you lived on a wall, what does that actually mean?
It just means I lived on a wall.
Literally, you lived...
I don't know if it's...
Were you a squatter?
I was also a squatter. I was in a lot of things. I was a junkie, a street person. When I needed to sleep inside, I would go to a squat. But usually I just stayed on the wall. It was called St. Anne's Court. And it was in Soho.
In London?
In London. Soho in London, right. Yes. And it was obviously that was a bombed out building from the World War II thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why I chose that wall or that place.
Now, where were all these people from your past?
Everybody says that.
You know, where...
Well, they didn't know where... I didn't know where they
you
were.
Just you disappeared from their lives, right?
I didn't want anybody to come and look for me. You know, I don't tell that story about my wall as a sort of... as an accusation to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was there... Because honestly, I thought that's what I wanted to do at the time, and it sort of healed me in a way. It was a very, not that I recommend it actually, but for the sort of the burnout I was going through, that wall and that situation was very good.
Mm.
Although. I mean, it's amazing to me now. Of course, I certainly couldn't do that, even think of doing it. I don't know how.
Now, you were addicted to heroin for, as I read the book, almost 20 years. I mean, it was
No. Not continuing.
Throughout most of the 70s and a good part of the 80s,
right? Not
all
the time, no.
You kicked it from time to time.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't be alive if I was. And I certainly wouldn't be like I am. No. I had long times where I didn't use heroin and didn't use them much at all, but it would always come back.
How did you support yourself? How did you live during like the wall periods and the squatting periods? Was there still money coming in from the recordings?
No, of course not. Anyway, there was so little. Uh-huh. In the '60s, in the early '60s, the amount of you got nothing for these things. It was very, very unlikely that I made much money at all, and I didn't. I made money more from my performances, but by the time I was on the wall, I wasn't performing. Obviously, I was very, very sick. I was in the National Health Program at the time, which was free.
Yeah. And you got heroin from the National Health Program.
But I got a prescription.
God.
It's not like that now, before every junkie in New York gets on the next flight to London.
Yeah, no, of course not.
It's not. It's
have
changed.
You just got to New York, and there's something going on in town now. There's a killer strain of heroin out there.
I always read those things.
You must still relate to that on some level.
Well,
right?
I don't directly. I mean, except that I'm glad it's not me, and I'm glad I'm not using.
What was?
I found myself reading it, so I must sort of.
What turned it around for you? There were two suicide attempts that you talk about in the book. Australia, when Jagger was out making that film,
Ned Kelly. Yeah, that didn't do it for me yet. It took more than that.
You took a lot of sleeping pills on that one, right?
Yes. One of the things that helped me, and it helps many a junkie, I think, if you're going to be able to be helped. Is when you see your friends die. That's one of the things that will sober you up quicker than almost anything. I think that's one of the things that helped me. They do say that, you know, that no junkie dies in vain. And I think it's a very interesting point.
I mean, you had a man that you were living with who literally committed suicide, went out
that's
a window.
That's really, you know? I think, that was when I realized, finally, that this was really very serious.
Yeah. And this was in the mid-80s sometime when that happened.
1986.
Yeah. Mm. You were living in New York at the time?
No, I was in Boston. I went to treatment in 1985, and so that was when I really got help.
You had OD'd on heroin, and there was a point that is described in the book where after you had injected it, you immediately sort of recognized what you had done and you rebelled against it.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, that's what I had this experience where I don't know what it was, but I do have a very intense sort of dream life, so I don't know whether... I really don't know, but what I did was take this huge overdose, and my heart stopped. And in fact, I fell, but I didn't know this at this moment, and broke my jaw. And then I had this experience of something asking me, "Do you really want to die?" And I realized I didn't, and I said, "No, I don't." And then I said, "Help me." And the next minute my heart was going again, a bit shakily, but going. And 3 weeks later, I got into treatment and I got help.
Through people at the record company, at Island Records, through Chris Blackwell. I mean, the story that you tell in the book is
like a blueprint of how to behave with artists who have got drug problems.
A woman from the record company came to visit you. She was looking for something in the apartment.
She was looking for a pen.
Right. She's opening drawers.
She opened the drawer, and in all the drawers, it was like a little coded message. And it sort of works in one drawer, coke in another, smack in another, and a thing to tie me up with in the other. Heavy. It was very heavy.
And she said, "I'll be right back."
She didn't say anything. That was what, I mean, she just went back to the office and obviously called Blackwell and called the people you had to call.
And then what happened? Did they come to you and say, "Look, you got to get straight," or what? I mean, how did you wind up? Then you were in.
It was very, very. I mean, it was. I was very lucky because I wouldn't have. I was desperate for help, and I couldn't go on like I was, and I knew it. But I wouldn't have been able to. I don't think I would have gone to anybody and said, "You must get me into treatment or I'm going to die." I wouldn't have been able to do that. I didn't understand that at all, that you have to actually consciously ask for help. I couldn't have done it. But they just did it. Somebody called me from London, Tom Hayes. He's still a friend of mine. And I think he worked for Ireland in the accountancy bit. And he had a big drinking problem, and he'd been to Hazelden. And Tom called me and said, "It was extremely cool." He said, "Well, what do you want to do now?" And nothing had been discussed. And I remember saying, Well, I'd really like to go to a health farm for a few weeks or something like mm-hmm. one of those things, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, I do need a bit of a break, it's true. I'll go to a health farm. What about, you know, Canyon Rudd? Or, and I remember Tom said, I think it's a bit more serious than that. And at that moment, I just sort of crumbled and said, yes, it is. And he said, well, we got you into this place. It's very good.
Hazleton?
Yes.
It's in the Midwest here
in
the States.
It's in Minneapolis, yeah. Yes.
And you were there for
I was
months,
there for
right?
a long time. Yeah. It's yeah. hardcore. And I went, but I got myself on the plane and I got myself to the airport and I got on the plane and I got there. And once I got to Minneapolis, they picked me up and took me up.
Never once in reading your book do I hear you say during all of this, but I'm Marianne Faithfull. You know? I mean,
I very rarely feel that.
Yeah, you know, I mean you never seem to acknowledge that. You never seem to either regret or you know
I am Marianne.
Yeah, you know, I mean
it's so normal. I mean I always think it doesn't need to be said. I know I'm Marianne Faithfull, that's the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter who you think I am,
right.
as long as I know
right.
that's having, all that matters.
Having survived two suicide attempts, and there's
I'm very lucky.
There's a story now. Can I just tell this
yes,
story in
yeah.
the book? The first time when you took a lot of sleeping pills, and you're
yeah.
in Australia, and you're living with Jagger, you're having a relationship with Jagger at that point. Was that before or after the miscarriage?
That was
after the miscarriage. Yeah. You were pregnant with a child by Mick. Mm. You had already a son by your first husband, who was basically living with your mother for.
Well, my son wasn't living with my mother at that time. Nicholas was living with Mick and I.
Okay.
It was only after Australia and after I split up with Mick and lost his protection, really, the thing, that Nicholas was taken away from me.
Mm.
But until he was seven, he lived with me.
Okay. Now you're out. You're in
Which actually makes the thing about the suicide attempt in Australia even more shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to say, yeah.
So you're out in a coma, pretty much.
I was out for 6 days.
For 6 days, and when you wake up, Jagger is in the room, and he says something.
I have to say, my mum was there too.
Okay, and he says something like, "Oh, you know, we thought we'd lost you." And did you really say to him, "Wild horses couldn't drag me away"?
Yeah.
God. Oh man.
I did.
Now, this, of course, is several years before he writes a song called
No,
Wild
he wrote
Horses.
It pretty soon after that.
Well, it was a while before he recorded it, though, I guess. But that's amazing.
I think when we all, by the time we got back to London, which must have been 6 months later, he had that song and he played it.
God.
I was delighted. I mean, it's all I really wanted at that time was to have some of my thoughts and ideas turned into art. You know, it was wonderful.
Sister Morphine was a song
I wrote
that
yes.
you wrote
yeah.
and then never got credit for, although you did.
Well, I have got it now.
Yeah.
I got the money. I was just after the war, actually, the time I was living there. When I got really sick of living on the wall and I really needed some money, and I rang up Alan Klein and said, look, I must have some money now because Sticky Fingers has come out and it's a big hit and where's my money? And that was when I found out that I didn't have a credit.
Why didn't they?
But I did get the money.
Why didn't they give you credit?
Oh, I don't know.
You wrote the words to Sister Morphine.
Yes, I did, but you know, the Rolling Stones don't share their writing credits with anybody. I don't think anyone else has ever got a credit. Although many people have helped with the songs, it's just not the way they are,
uh-huh.
you know. Although I was determined to get my credit and all my money, and I did. But my case was different. I mean, it wasn't just the fact, I wasn't just in the room at the time or something. I actually sat down and wrote those lyrics all myself. But, you know, it doesn't matter. There's a lot of things like that happen when people split up and when they're upset with each other. And, you know.
I'm still...
I lost the cat, too.
So you wake up from a 6-day coma, and Mick Jagger's sitting there in his Ned Kelly costume or something like that, and he says, "Marianne, we almost lost you," and you looked up at him and said, "Wild horses wouldn't drag me away from you."
Well, it was a moment of pure love.
Yes.
And I love the song.
Marianne Faithfull, what happens when you hear that or one of the many other songs that you were party to that were maybe written for you or about you when you're just like walking through a supermarket or something and a song comes on the radio? I mean, what happens? These are songs that are such a part of our pop culture that to find out that the reason why that song was written was because, you know, he was responding to what you said when you came out of a coma after having tried to commit suicide.
That's how songs get written.
Yes, but we don't even think of that anymore with the Rolling Stones, you know?
Well, I'm sure they're still writing about their lives
as they are
now.
Of course.
I don't know. I always think it's just I happen to be there, that's all. That sort of thing. But Wild Horses is a special one, and I'm always moved when I hear it.
You can't always get what you
I'm
want.
I'm always moved when I hear that.
Yeah, that was one that was that was written for you or about you.
Very clear. Yeah. But many characters in that song, and I'm one of them.
Now, people shouldn't get the impression that this book, this autobiography of yours, is all dark down and full of great inner turmoil depression and stuff like that. There's some wonderful, marvelous stories, and fully half the book, if not even more than half the book, is about that period in the 60s, that swinging mod London period in the 60s.
That was our directive, you see. So that's really what they wanted, so that's what we did. And in a way, it was very useful for me, that, because I had to really write about the stuff that people know about anyway, which is my involvement with Mick Jagger and the 60s and my drug addiction, and then my work coming out of that, like Broken English and all my work up to now. There's an awful lot of my life I haven't had to go into because nobody knows about it, nobody cares, which is nice. So it stays to be mine.
Some things you have to keep private, right?
Yes.
There's a very funny scene in the book that revolves around one of the first times, if not the first time, you and Jagger were finally alone together and were about to consummate this flirtation, this thing that had been going on.
Yeah.
You know the story I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, about the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is funny.
Can you tell the story?
It's very funny. I can't remember it now, of course. When I went down to Bristol, I'd been invited by Keith and Brian, who were great friends of mine, and I went down to see them. I don't think I'd seen them before. And it was very, very fascinating, and I was sort of completely fascinated. And that night, we all went back to some motel somewhere in Bristol, and watched Repulsion. I remember that.
Oh.
And smoked a lot of grass.
Roman Polanski
yeah. And all that stuff. And it was a great night, and it went on and on and on, like these nights always do. And in the end, I found myself alone with Mick. And I didn't quite know what to do. I'm never very good at this moment. So we went for a walk in the morning. Sort of the sun was rising and the dew and all that stuff. And on that walk, we had this conversation about...
You began testing him.
Well, that's what I think so, yes. And he passed.
You were asking him all these questions
about the Holy Grail and King Arthur
and mythology,
Lancelot du Lac, and all that stuff.
Because you wanted to know that he was.
I don't know. I didn't realize it at the time, but of course, when I came to tell David all these stories, that was very fascinating about, you know, telling someone else and seeing how he saw it. That was very odd, because I had a lot of these things I'd never really talked about.
But at some point, Mick turns to you and says, Marianne, did I pass the test?
Yeah.
Then there's another scene where you guys are about to have some wonderful romantic moment, and some band comes barging in.
That's so funny, yes. The Small Faces, with all their amps and guitars. But, I mean, you know that's how musicians are. We all know that.
they just knocked on the door and said, hey, we want a jam?
We have a jam.
No, excuse me, please.
Oh, no, we're having much too polite.
A private moment here.
We're much too polite to say that.
Now, because people know of your drug problems, your drug addiction and stuff, people have always assumed that Sister Morphine is you. Sister Morphine, even though you wrote the words to it, Sister Morphine is somebody else. What's the story behind Sister Morphine?
I think I wrote Sister Morphine for Anita. Well, though neither Anita or
Anita Pallenberg.
Anita Pallenberg.
Who was...
one of my dearest friends. Still is one of my dearest friends.
Keith's consort. She was also consort. Is that a good word? Can we use that? Girlfriend.
Yes,
girlfriend.
Is not I really think of her as, I suppose this is terrible to say this, but I think of her as his wife, really.
But she had
first
been,
wife.
She had been with, she had been with Brian before that, but Keith always kind of, according to your book, was always in love with her.
Well, I don't know. You know, these are all speculation, but I think so, yes. And Anita was amazing and still is. I think I wrote it for her, really. But none of us were using hard drugs at the time I wrote Sister Morphine. And it's true that in a way it was something that was to come.
Wasn't there something too about a story about somebody who was injured or something in a car crash?
Well, that was my external story. I mean, all my songs have always got what I think they're about, what they're really about,
right,
and what underneath all those things I think they are actually about.
Uh-huh.
And of course it's many, many levels. But my actual sort of little scenario for Sister Morphine was in fact a man who's had a car crash, who's in hospital and is in great pain and needs a shot of morphine. But I do think that I wrote it really for Anita.
And that's Marianne Faithfull's version of Sister Morphine, which finally appeared on a Greatest Hits album that came out on CD. But until it appeared on that Greatest Hits album, it sort of floated around, that version of the song.
Yes, and I wrote it 2 years at least, or 3 years before Sticky Fingers,
before the Rolling Stones
recorded it. I must have been very ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And it's still quite a shock, that song, because it's so sort of graphic.
You say that Ry Cooder's playing on that track?
Yes, that's right.
Who was playing the keyboard, do you recall?
That's Jack Nietzsche.
It's Jack Nietzsche who produced it?
Yeah. Well, Mick produced it,
Mick produced it?
Yeah. And the drums is Charlie.
Now listen, I found the scene in the book. Mick as Shiva.
Oh yes.
Now let me just pause here for some commercials. And is it all right with you? Can I read something from the book?
Yes. Okay. If you work.
All right. Now let's listen to this scene from Marianne Faithfull's autobiography. Now, are you in fact the first living person that David Dalton has worked with?
Yes, I have that dubious honor.
Because he wrote a book about.
I am in fact first living subject that Dalton's.
Because he wrote about Joplin, he wrote about Morrison.
Peace of My Heart is the Joplin one.
He wrote about, he did one of the early biographies of James Dean.
Yes.
And then he did...
And the one about Jim Morrison.
Mr. Mojo Rising.
Yes. I like the Janis one very much.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I chose David to be my co-writer, my ghost, as I call him.
Okay. Now listen to this. During our first few months in Harley House, which was where you and Mick were living, Mick and I spent a lot of time alone. It's where we got to know each other. Mick played me records, The Miracles, Slim Harpo, Robert Johnson, and I introduced him to books. It was one of the best bits of our life. But even at Harley House, it wasn't easy to be alone with Mick because he was so magnetic and everybody wanted to be around him. After Harley House, our privacy was hard to hold on to. As we moved to the house in Chester Square and later to Chain, is that how that's
called?
Chaney Walk. There was a constant parade of visitors, people dropping by at all hours of the day and night, dinner parties. Our drugs in those early days consisted mostly of grass, acid, and the occasional leaper. Leaper being an upper speed. Okay. And you make a point about Mick was never like a real hard drug
not
person,
sure,
was he?
No.
You know, Keith was like a serious junkie, but Mick never got into that,
well,
huh?
Maybe because he's so athletic, too. Mind you, what am I saying? All these athletes on drugs now. But
yeah, right.
I always think that's a way where if you have any vague idea of how complicated the body is and how what you can get out of it, I would have thought that would stop you from being completely self-destructive.
Marianne Faithfull, isn't part of what attracted you to Mick was that of all of the people in that scene and in the Stones, he was the one who seemed most rooted, most down to earth, most...
He was the most together, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because people have always said, oh, Mick's the businessman. Mick's,
well, I know that's true, but of course I didn't. That's not what I saw.
Yeah.
But he was very, very kind and very beautiful. And clever, obviously. Clever as anything. I'll always like clever people.
People have always said, oh, the Rolling Stones, you know, the misogynist band of all time. Does he hate women? I mean, he can't.
Oh, no. I mean, it's obviously in writing this book, I had to really sort of touch on that subject, on the misogyny of rock and roll. Or it would have been terrible. It would have been a big hole in the book. Uh-huh. But I don't know if I can really say. I mean, the thing about hating women, it's always, you have to go at it from both sides. Somebody who is frightened and seemingly has hatred towards women also has incredible love towards women. It all goes together. Mm. I mean, Mick obviously loves women. But women can be a lot of trouble.
There was a period there where you were just sort of one of the boys, too,
I thought so,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
you were part of this boys' club.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let me get back to this. We're in Cheney Walker's, someplace like
Harley
that, right?
Marston.
No hard drugs around.
No.
That was one of the nice things about Mick. He really wasn't into drugs. He was very straight always. A little acid, a little grass. Mm. I'd probably be dead by now if I'd been involved with, if I'd been involved with somebody like me,
yeah.
You're saying. Mick just liked a bit of smoke and an occasional drink. He was a terrible drunk. We did acid, mostly because I was always egging him on. We have to do some of this stuff, Mick. Come on, let's get Keith and Brian and Anita to come over and all drop acid.
Oh, can you imagine? I was just like that in the 60s.
Mick and I hadn't been in Harley House very long before we decided to take a trip together. And so one afternoon, as one did in those days, we made preparations. We got out the Ravi Shankar records, Blonde on Blonde, Otis Redding, all the sonic spirits that would accompany us. We took the phone off the hook and dressed for the occasion. Just as the acid was coming on, I remember Mick going over to the gramophone, carrying one of those green, transparent plastic records that the Indian ragas came on. He sat down very ceremoniously in the middle of the floor. It was Ali Akbar Khan, flute and tabla, and as the flute began to quaver, Mick rose up, his whole body twisting in a corkscrew like a cobra coming out of its basket. And then he started to dance. It was a specific sort of dance, an Indian dance, the dance brightly painted men and women do in Bengali movies, very different from the lascivious dance he does in performance. This was pure beauty and exaltation, a great dance and dancer, another being. And as Mick danced, an extraordinary change came over him. It was as if he were unwinding himself like a mummy, shedding layers of wrapping, revealing at the core of this suburban English boy's body a many-armed, blue-headed dancing god, the macrocosmic Mick.
Brilliant.
I was seeing Mick, the brain bell jongleur, the real Mick, if there is such a thing. The dance was very, very fast, practically on one spot. He was starting to vibrate so quickly that his body was breaking up into molecules. Now, you know that David Dalton has taken a lot of acid as well.
Yes, yes.
To be able to write these visions this way.
Yes, but this is very much how I told him.
Shimmering, phosphorescent particles. Mm-hmm. I was completely transfixed, hardly breathing. As he moved, his hands in stroboscopic flutters, they multiplied and fanned out, overlapping each other. The formality was incredible. He had become Shiva, I hadn't realized until then that I was living with somebody who at odd moments could turn into a god. It was a blissful, ecstatic moment suspended in time. We could have gone on all night. We hadn't even got to the part where we were going to make love. And F me if the bell doesn't ring and in walk all the small faces with their gear, amps, and guitars and mic stands. At the high point of our trip, they'd drop by the jam, man.
Yep.
That deft boys game of all we want to do is rock and roll. God. And we were too polite and high to kick them out. It was one of those awful moments of polarization. The mundane world bursting in. The gentleman from Porlock.
I love the gentleman from Porlock, yes. It's brilliant.
That is such a great scene.
It's very good, yes. I mean, it's very much, it is very much exactly how I told him, but of course he's worked it very beautifully. Mm.
You have, I mean, there are vivid memories that you have of those acid trips.
Could I forget a scene like that? I mean, obviously. And the most amazing thing was just in June, I went I was here in New York, and I went to the museum, the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, to see the big Asian exhibition. It was a wonderful exhibition. And I'm a member, you know, and off I went with my little card. I went a lot of times, and what I found there was a sort of, I think it was a 5th century bronze of Shiva, and it was exactly
it was exactly
and it's right there,
the
with
arms,
all the
yeah,
arms
right.
It's the most beautiful thing.
God.
And it's exactly, that's what I saw, and I saw it. To actually see it as a bronze in front of you is so amazing.
And then these guys show up and want to party.
Well,
play rock and roll.
I mean, you can't, they can't help that.
Yeah.
You know, that they are like that. All musicians are like that. That's all they really want to do, is just cart their amps about and set them up everywhere and just play all the time. And I understand that. I mean, sort of,
You frequently describe in the book Mick and Keith just walking around places with guitars, just all the time, coming up with
really
melodies.
Really, why
and stuff.
I was able. I mean, that's why I wrote Sister Morphine, because I got tired of it, actually hearing that riff all the time, and I waited for ages, you know, about 6 months went by where nothing happened, he didn't write it.
Whose riff was it, Keith's or Mick?
Mix.
It was Mix.
No, it was all very separate, really. But it was Mick's riff, and it was beautiful, but I got tired of it and I wanted him to move on. So I realized that someone would have to do it, and I wrote the words.
Now, in addition to writing songs and working with Barry Reynolds, who has been a songwriting
partner of
yours.
He's just the same. Barry Reynolds, you just give him an amp and a guitar and he'll just go off. Just like, they're all like that music, you know.
You are, of course, also a wonderful interpreter of songs and have become a prime person to do, for instance, the music of Kurt Vile. I mean, you were part
that's
of Hal Wilner's Lost in the Stars
yes,
collection.
Yes, that was the first time I met Hal.
And the very Kurt Vile-ish stuff that Tom Waits does. Mm. There's that Strange Weather song. It's just a great Tom Waits song. And your voice is so well suited to that, too.
Yeah.
And you've done Three Penny Opera. You performed.
Yes, I did. I played Pirate Jenny.
Uh-huh.
3 years ago now, in Dublin at the Gate Theatre.
Perfect.
It was
I mean, it's a perfect marriage of role and actress.
It was wonderful.
There is a new album that's just come out that has on it the perfect marriage of song and song interpreter. And I'm talking about an album of Van Morrison songs called No Prima Donna that has just been released.
Mm.
And on it, there is a Mary Ann Faithful version of Madame George. And when I looked at that, I said, oh, God, of course.
Well, and that's how Van saw it,
it's
too.
It's perfect. Mary Ann Faithful and Madame George belong together.
And Van Morrison filtered through Kurt Vile.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, I mean, he knows all that.
Now, Van was in the studio for this, right?
Van
Didn't
produced
he
it.
Produced it, yeah. So he came to you and asked you to do it?
Oh, not exactly. No, Van doesn't go to anybody. I don't know how this happened. I think it was probably his manager called my manager, one of those things.
Right,
But I'm friends with Van, and I've known him for a long, long time, and he's just wonderful. And I said I would do it, but only if he produced it.
Mm-hmm. You do agree with me.
Be there.
You do agree that it is the perfect marriage, isn't it?
I think it probably is, yes.
It turned out very, very well, anyway. We were very pleased.
It was the first track that I played when I got the CD, and I just got this big smile on my face. It's gorgeous.
Little Shana, Miss Morrison, Van's daughter.
Van's daughter?
Yes, singing backups. She's lovely.
Wow. That's Marianne Faithfull from No Prima Donna, the songs of Van Morrison. That also includes a gorgeous reading of Coney Island by Liam Neeson and Sinead O'Connor's on the album, and Elvis doing full force scale a cappella.
Yeah.
It's great stuff.
It is.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Marianne Faithfull is my guest here on Idiot's Delight. This is 92.3 K-Rock. We are here tonight with the mad woman of this. There's a quote somewhere about
the mad woman of Shy
Oak. Yeah, sort of. You know, I mean, you became a kind of a strange,
wraith-like,
ephemeral creature there for so many years.
So sad.
I mean, but you are so down to earth and so rooted now. I mean, you just seem so. God forbid I should use this word normal. I mean, you know, you're just such a friendly, giving person at this point.
I think I'm very lucky, and I did get a lot of help. You see, I had a very good shrink.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that really helped me was acupuncture. And I have a feeling they really did something that sort of, I would think of it like sort of changing the wiring of someone.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I still do that.
Do you fear at all slipping back?
I do fear. I don't want to slip back. You can never say, that's that, I'll never do that again, because it's such an insidious drug and such a strange sort of form of social, I don't know what, you know, it's a very odd business that.
Marianne, do you have a support system now?
First of all, I have a really good team working with me. And, of course, my life isn't just work. I have more friends than I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. And I have more of a sense of myself in relationship to others, which I didn't have when I was little or young.
Yeah.
Saw myself alone.
You have a grandchild.
I do. Oscar. Yes.
This is Nicholas's son.
Nicholas's first son.
How old is he?
He was one on the 12th of July.
Oh, God. Oh, that's cool.
He's walking now.
Does Nicholas live in America?
Nicholas, no. He's in London, uh-huh, with Carol. They just got married, actually.
He's involved in film somehow?
Yes. He's in film. He's coming to New York quite soon, actually. He's going down with Hal Wilner is going to record The Naked Lunch on a audio book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Nicholas is going down with Hal to Lawrence to film it.
Burroughs is going to do it himself.
William's going to read it himself.
Yeah, nobody reads Burroughs like Burroughs. And you get that nasal, that deadpan voice of
brilliant.
His, you know.
Yeah. But William has never wanted to read a Naked Lunch, so it's quite a big thing.
Mm.
It's very exciting.
Now, Wilner will do some incidental music for it as well?
Yes, Levy will, yes.
Now, the infamous Steve Leeds is here with Marianne Faithfull. Steve, can you tell us where Marianne's going to be? She's going to be doing a book signing. Come here, come to the microphone, Steve. Don't be shy. And no, not that one. This one. This one over here. Yeah.
Oh.
Where's the book signing going to be?
Wednesday evening at Rizzoli's down in Soho.
Downtown?
Yep.
The famous Steve Leeds.
Yeah.
When was the last time Howard Stern gave out your phone number? It's been a while, huh?
It's been a long time.
All right, Rizzoli's down on,
West Broadway.
West Broadway, Wednesday night. What time?
Around dinner time, around 6-ish.
6, okay. And she'll be signing copies of the book?
Books, CDs.
Okay, great. The book, of course, is called Faithfull, an autobiography, Marianne Faithfull, written with David Dalton. The album, which has Strange Weather and Broken English and The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, is also called Faithfull, and the two have been released sort of in conjunction with each other. There, you know what I was amazed to find out, because I never really looked at the credits before? There's a song of yours that I've never played on the radio because I never wanted to censor it. And that's the song, Why Do You Do It?
Why'd you do it,
right?
Yeah.
I never wanted to. I tried. You know, I tried putting I know a lot of radio stations did. They censored out all the naughty bits, you know? But it didn't. To me, it was like almost sacrilegious. The song was so valid the way it was that it didn't make sense to me to try and,
I know.
You know?
It was funny for me, though, when I first came to New York on the back of that. I remember going around radios and things. It must have been 78 or early 79. And everywhere I went, I heard Wedge do it, all with the words bleeped out. It was very peculiar.
Now, this is a song, this is an angry song about a woman who is full of rage and jealousy over the fact that her man has gone off and slept with another woman, and it's
a song
very
about
graphic.
Sexual jealousy. Probably the most archetypal thing about sexual jealousy ever.
One of the things that I found so revealing and shocking reading your book is that it was written by a man. It was a poem written by a man.
Yes, a great poet, actually. Escott Williams.
Because everybody who ever heard that song assumed it was your song, you know, and assumed
it was my song, but I didn't write it.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm. I wish I had. I would give anything to have written that. But then there's a lot of songs I wish I'd written.
And he captured that female rage perfectly, didn't he?
Well, of course, it's in reality. If you read it now, you'd see it was a dialogue. Which is also very interesting.
Yeah.
There are two parts.
There are two voices
part,
there.
His voice and her voice, and they're having a dialogue.
Yeah.
But you also don't necessarily get that from them.
We have a recording of Allen Ginsberg. It's on CART back in the office. You know the bleep song? Before you go, we did something with Allen once.
Yeah.
Where we took a recording, a song that I don't know. I think it was a song, like a bluesy thing, that he did a couple of years ago on one of his albums.
I must have heard.
And it's a real graphic song full of all sorts of body parts and stuff, you know, and slang expressions for body parts.
Yeah.
And so we bleeped all that out. It's called Come On Jack, I think, or something like
I've
that.
I've heard it, yeah.
And then we decided to bleep out lots of other things as well. So we just bleeped out random words. We bleeped out guitar notes from a guitar solo. In other words, the power of suggestion would then cause the listener to put in
all sorts
of words that weren't really there.
That's how you get everyone to participate.
Right.
In
now,
this.
So before we leave, before you leave tonight, I want you to hear that.
Yeah.
I also want to play Ghost Dance.
Oh,
Patti Smith.
Love that. Yes.
Patti Smith, Lenny Kaye song.
Yes.
That is on the new CD. This has never been released before.
No, we only recorded it 4 months ago in Dublin. We did it for an AIDS project in Ireland that I'm working on to try and get people with HIV, who are HIV positive in Ireland, some of the services that we have here in New York, like somebody to come and clean your house and do the shopping, and the sort of things you can't do when you're sick. So this is something towards that. But it turned out so well that we put it on the compilation.
And you work with Keith on this.
Keith is playing on it. It's Keith on lead guitar, Ronnie Wood on acoustic, and Charlie Watts, of course, wonderful. And Don Was is playing bass.
Oh, the ubiquitous Don Was.
The wondrous, the fab.
Patti Smith's Ghost Dance. And this is such a... it's such a perfect song, again, for you to be doing this whole, you know, we shall live again notion. I mean, because you've been through those downs and you've survived and come out the other end.
Not through anything I did right.
No.
But I've been very lucky. And I have managed to get through to here, yes. Thanks.
Mary Ann Faithful. Let's listen to this.
I'm dying to, I want to forget.
From the new CD compilation called Faithful, simply Faithful. There is a previously unreleased recording of Mary Ann Faithful's. It's Patti Smith and Lenny Kaye's Ghost Dance.
Mm. Yeah.
And again, a perfect song for you, for your voice. But you can hear on these newer recordings now, you can hear that your voice has changed a little bit again. It's not quite as deep, especially on that the Van Morrison song, the Madame George. It gets up a little higher.
It's sweeter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
But maybe it's because you're...
I must have changed.
You're, you know, I mean, maybe...
Because I'm less angry, probably.
Not only that, but I mean, you don't have those drugs in your system anymore.
No, I don't.
You know, I mean, when you were doing Broken English and all those things, there was other stuff going on in your life.
Broken English, yes, but Strange Weather, I was completely clean.
Yeah.
But there was still a much deeper, darker edge to my voice.
Yeah. Let me play this Allen Ginsberg recording that we decided to bleep more than was necessary. So anyhow, that's probably the first time that guitars have ever actually been bleeped, you know. And it was a musical bleep, too. It was like, you know, the tones changed and stuff. Now, listen, Marianne Faithfull, this has been an absolute pleasure having you here on the radio tonight. The book is published in hardcover by Little Brown. It's called Faithfull, an Autobiography. As I said earlier, it's really not the typical rock autobiography, because something happens in it where you just, as a reader, and I've talked to others who have had the same experience, where you just absolutely get absorbed by your story, because it is such an absorbing story. I mean, it's an incredible tale.
And David did an awfully good job.
Yeah, it's very well
and
written.
We worked on it very hard. We did a lot of editing. There's a whole thing where we continually flip from the present to the past to the future, which is a very interesting way of keeping someone's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, our publishers weren't at all sure that this would work. I was absolutely sure it would. I thought, this is the only time you really can do that in an autobiography. I mean, it's what I think all the time. But it was really wonderful to do that. You know, to say, well, and this had happened in the past, and then this was going to come, and now this...
Yeah, there's a lot of projection.
Where time really goes in a circle.
Right. It's good stuff. It certainly is good stuff. And the fact that you have come out of this as healthy and warm as you are...
It's just... I know.
It's wonderful.
Really?
Now, there's an album coming out next year, I guess early in the new year, of all new material.
Well, it's my new album,
okay,
which I worked on. I wrote it with Angelo Badalamenti.
Now, he's the guy who did
Twin Peaks. And a lot of David Lynch's music for his films. And, of course, he's actually a working muso and has been for years.
Now, there is one song from that forthcoming album that is on this compilation that just came out that has been released called Faithfull, which has come out in conjunction with the book. It's called She.
Mm.
And with,
we're very proud of that.
With my thanks to you for a wonderful evening of conversation and for just being so open and honest and so real about it all. Because the feeling I got from your book is the feeling that I'm getting from you now, you know, talking to you, meeting you. And I must confess, I was a little scared. I was a little nervous about meeting you, because I thought, oh my God, Marianne Faithfull, why'd you do it? I mean, that Marianne Faithfull was a scary woman, you know. And you're wonderful. You're delightful. So I'm so glad that we did this.
It's lovely.
Marianne Faithfull.